Hey rockers, welcome back. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. So, last show we discussed the awesome lyrical songs in the folk rock genre. Today, I want to talk about a somewhat similar type of rock music that was also raging during the 1960s, and this is psychedelic rock. So psychedelic rock originated from a diverse style of rock music which was inspired, influenced, or representative of the psychedelic culture. And this was centered on the perception-altering hallucinogenic drugs. So the music itself is intended to replicate or even enhance the mind-altering experiences of psychedelic drugs such as LSD, which kind of involved three core effects, which were depersonalization, dechronicization, and dynamization. And all of these kind of detach the user from actual reality. Musically, the effects are represented through studio tricks, electronic instrumentation, disjunctive song structures, and extended instrumental segments. So all of this new experimentation with these powerful drugs actually came from elements of Indian music and other Eastern music that these bands started getting involved with. So as the counterculture scene that we kind of talked about in previous shows began to develop in San Francisco, the term psychedelic rock was used in 1966 to describe the new drug-influenced music. And all of this evolved from the other genres we discussed in previous shows. This included the British Invasion experimentation, surf sound instrumentals such as The Ventures or the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds album, and anti-war protest lyrics such as Bob Dylan's. So, I want to talk about a huge precursor to psychedelic music, and it started with the Beatles' experimentation that was discussed during the British Invasion, and their desire to escape racism and violence, as well as materialism of adult life that was going on at this time. So to start, as I mentioned, the Beatles' albums, Rubber Soul and Revolver, were recognized as the first two Beatle albums that sort of marked the beginning of the psychedelic era, along with their influences, actually particularly George Harrison's influence, on Indian culture. So the Beatles are becoming a true voice of the generation regarding issues such as the emerging hippie counterculture and the Vietnam War, which is much of what this music is about. Their huge experimental approach really burst as they recorded their iconic album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and this was recorded in late November of 1966. So according to the engineer named Geoff Emerick, the album's recording actually took over 700 hours. Sgt. Pepper actually topped the UK charts for 23 consecutive weeks, with a further 4 weeks at number one in the period through February of 1968. So with 2.5 million copies sold, actually within the first 3 months of its release, Sgt. Pepper's initial commercial success exceeded that of all other Beatles albums. This was the most popular. It sustained its immense popularity into the 21st century and broke a lot of sales records. In 2003, Rolling Stone ranked Sgt. Pepper at number one on its list of the greatest albums of all time. And this album was known for incorporating a range of stylistic influences, and this included the vaudeville, circus, music hall, avant-garde, and Western and Indian classical music. So, following this album, Paul McCartney wanted to create a film that captured a psychedelic theme, which was becoming more popular at this time. So, titled Magical Mystery Tour, it would combine an idea of a psychedelic bus ride with McCartney's memories of his time and the band's time growing up in Liverpool. He also intended to have the film to be unscripted. He wanted various ordinary people traveling on a coach and have unspecified magical adventures. All right, so in February of 1968, the Beatles actually traveled to a place called Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's Ashram in Rishikesh, India. And they did this to take part in a 3-month meditation guide course. So their time in India kind of marked one of the band's most prolific periods, inspired numerous songs, and included a majority of those on their next album. But unfortunately, this trip was not as spiritual as they actually hoped for. Ringo Starr actually left this trip after only 10 days because he was unable to eat the such diverse food that was given to them. Paul McCartney eventually grew bored and departed a month later into the trip. And John Lennon and George Harrison actually claimed that Maharishi was attempting to manipulate them and made inappropriate advances to the women attendees at this trip, so they left 2 months into the course. So finally, the Beatles eventually made and performed their forthcoming single, All You Need Is Love. And they performed this to about 350 million viewers on live TV, and it was released a week later during the Summer of Love. And the song was adopted as sort of a flower power anthem during that summer of love. So, after this quick break, I will be discussing the Summer of Love, which was located in San Francisco as the hippie movement began to spark. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. What's up, rockers? My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. So, as I previously mentioned, after the Beatles and other experimentation groups influenced psychedelia, we're beginning to see the Summer of Love uprising. So, the Summer of Love sparked in San Francisco and emerged as the movement's capital on the West Coast. So, along with British influences, several California-based folk acts brought their psychedelic influences to create a new San Francisco sound. Their music scene actually developed in the city's Haight and Ashbury neighborhood in 1965, and it was actually in basement shows, which was organized by Chet Helms of the Family Dog, and as Jefferson Airplane founder, whose name is Marty Balin, opened the Matrix nightclub that summer where bands began to play and become big. So eventually, college and high school students began streaming into the Haight during the spring break of 1967. And actually, ironically, the local government officials actually tried to stop the huge influx of the young people coming to this area once schools ended for the summer, but it did backfire and actually brought more attention to the scene instead, and the media was exposed to the growing hippie scene. Eventually, some Haight Ashbury residents actually responded by forming the Council of the Summer of Love. That summer, the area's population went from 15,000 to around 100,000 people. After the famous Monterey Pop Festival that occurred that June, at this festival, lots of psychedelic artists actually got their name. So during the Summer of Love, the streets were filled with hippie music, drugs, anti-war, and free love scenes throughout the American West Coast, and it actually made it all the way to New York. These hippies, and sometimes called flower children, were suspicious of the government, rejected consumerist values, and generally opposed the Vietnam War, much like other groups talked about at this time, or other rock genres. And actually, few were just concerned more with art or spiritual and meditative practices, so they all had their own reason for being there. So with that being said, let me introduce some of my favorite or big artists that actually came from the Summer of Love, starting with the Grateful Dead. So the Grateful Dead formed in 1965 in Palo Alto, California. They're known for their eclectic style live performances of lengthy instrumental jams. And they're also known for their devoted fan base, and these people were known as Deadheads. So the founding members of the Grateful Dead were Jerry Garcia, who was lead guitar and vocals, Bob Weir, who was rhythm guitar and vocals, Ron Pigpen, Mick Kernan, who was keyboards, harmonica, and vocals, Phil Lesh, who was bass and vocals, and Bell Kreutzmann, who was on the drums. So the first show that was actually under the name Grateful Dead was in San Jose on December 4th of 1965. And the name Grateful Dead was apparently chosen from a dictionary. The definition that there was the soul of a dead person or his angel showing gratitude to someone who, as an act of charity, arranged their burial. So, one of the group's earliest major performances in 1967 was at the Mantra Rock Dance, and it was a musical event held on January 29th of that year at the Avalon Ballroom by the San Francisco Hare Krishna Temple. And one thing to note about the Dead, and actually most psychedelic groups in general, was their live performances. So while previous groups we mentioned were best known for more of their album releases and what's their next hit song going to be, these bands were actually at their best during their live performances, mostly because they were improvised, and especially the Dead's shows. So while rock and roll bands often rehearse a standard set, they played with minor variations. The Grateful Dead did not prepare in this way. Garcia actually stated in a 1966 interview, "We don't make our sets beforehand. We'd rather work off the tops of our heads than off a piece of paper." So, for each performance, the band actually drew material from an active list of 100 or so songs. So the band's primary lyricists, Robert Hunter and John Perry Barlow, commonly used themes involving love and loss, life and death, gambling and murder, beauty and horror, chaos and order, God and other religious themes, traveling and touring, and so on. So that being said, the Grateful Dead toured constantly throughout their career, playing more than 2,300 concerts. So they promoted a sense of community among their fans, which is really what they're known for. As I mentioned, the Deadheads, many of them actually followed their tours for months or even years on end, up to the point where they kind of created a communal marketplace, which was known as Shakedown Street, and it served as kind of a centers of activity where fans could buy and sell anything from grilled cheese sandwiches to homemade t-shirts and recordings of Grateful Dead concerts. And the band absolutely loved these kinds of things and actually dedicated their time and talent to their community and Deadheads. The Haight-Ashbury area of San Francisco, actually they went there and making available free food, lodging, music, and healthcare to all. And it was said that the band performed more free concerts than any band in the history of music. So over the years, a number of iconic images have come to be associated with the Grateful Dead. Many of these images originated as artwork for concert posters or album covers. One of which to know is the Skull and Roses design we all know, and it was composed by Alton Kelly and Stanley Moose, who added lettering and color to a black and white drawing, which was made by Edmund Joseph Sullivan. And this design originally appeared on a poster for the September 16th and 17th, 1966 Grateful Dead shows at the Avalon Ballroom. And so later, this design was also used as the cover album of the album titled Grateful Dead, which was made in 1971. Another prominent image for the Dead was the Dancing Bears. So these were a series of kind of stylized bears who kind of appeared to be dancing in a line, and they're all very colorful. It was drawn by Bob Thomas, and it was kind of, at first, part of the back cover for their album titled History of the Grateful Dead, Volume 1, Bear's Choice, which was made in 1973. So the bear is actually a reference to Owsley Bear Stanley, who actually recorded and produced this album. Alright, so in 2004, Rolling Stone ranked The Grateful Dead at number 57 on their list of the 100 greatest bands of all time. And on February 7th of 2007, The Grateful Dead received a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. So they're a very well-known band even today, and influenced many styles of music. Alright, so now I want to discuss Jefferson Airplane. So Jefferson Airplane, it was based in San Francisco, California, and they became one of the pioneering bands of psychedelic rock. They formed in 1965, and the group defined the San Francisco sound and was the first from the Bay Area to actually achieve international commercial success. The original group consisted of Marty Balin on vocals, Paul Kantner on guitar and vocals, Grace Slick on vocals, Jorma Kaukonen on lead guitar and vocals, Jack Cassidy on bass, and Spencer Dryden on drums. So with a group of investors, Balin, as I mentioned earlier, purchased a former pizza parlor on Fillmore Street and converted it into a music club, which was named The Matrix, and he began searching for members of his group. Kaukonen came up with the band's name based on the name of a friend's dog. So the group made its first public appearance as Jefferson Airplane at the opening night of The Matrix on August 13th of 1965. The band expanded from its folk roots, drawing inspiration from the Beatles, the Byrds, and the Loving Spoonful, and kind of gradually developed a more pop-oriented electric sound. The group's debut LP album, which was titled Jefferson Airplane Takes Off, was released in September of 1966. This album was folk music influenced and included John Dee's Loudermilk's Tobacco Road and Dino Valentine's Let's Get Together, as well as original ballads such as It's No Secret and Come Up the Years. So, although the group never performed outside the Bay Area nor appeared on TV, this album actually got a lot of attention in the US and sold well enough to actually earn a gold record award. It sold more than 10,000 copies in San Francisco alone. And the band's breakthrough actually occurred when they recruited their iconic member, Grace Slick. Grace Slick possessed a powerful and contralto voice that kind of complemented Balin's and was well suited to the group's amplified psychedelic music. And as a former model, her good looks and stage presence actually greatly enhanced the group's live performance impact. Their iconic song, White Rabbit, was actually written by Grace Slick while she was still with her old band, The Great Society, but is known as a legendary Airplane song. Their next huge album was Surrealistic Pillow. It made it to number 200, or on the 200 album chart, on March 25th, and remained there for over a year, peaking at number 3. It sold over a million copies and was awarded another gold disc. And the name Surrealistic Pillow was actually suggested by the album's shadow producer, you may know him as Jerry Garcia, when he mentioned that, as a whole, the album sounded as surrealistic as a pillow is soft. Both the songs Somebody to Love and White Rabbit became major US hits, and it reached number 5 and later number 8 on the Billboard singles chart. So by 1967, the Airplane was a national and international star and had to become one of the hottest groups in America. And they were really known for originating kind of a romanticism for the electronic age that we see in the future years. So now I want to bring the attention over to some solo artists who kind of define psychedelic. So after this quick break, I will discuss this. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. Welcome back, rockers. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock right here on Penguin Radio. So, we are in the midst of a psychedelic rock, and I will now continue with the iconic Janis Joplin. So, Janis Joplin was one of the most successful and widely known rock stars of her era. She was noted for her powerful mezzo-soprano vocals and electric stage presence. Joplin rose to fame after her appearance at Monterey Pop Festival, where she was the lead singer of the then little-known San Francisco psychedelic rock band known as Big Brother and the Holding Company. So after releasing two albums with this band, she left Big Brother to continue as a solo artist with her own backing groups. The first was Cosmic Blues Band, and then the Full Tip Boogie Band. And one thing to note was, growing up, Joplin stated that she was kind of ostracized and bullied in high school. As a teenager, she became overweight and suffered from severe acne, leaving her with deep scars. Other kids at high school would always taunt her and call her names like pig, freak, and a creep. So she had a notably rough childhood and actually suffered a lot with her self-image. And one thing to note about this is it really kind of turned her into drugs. In 1963, Joplin was arrested in San Francisco for shoplifting. And during the 2 years that followed, her drug use really increased, and she was kind of acquired a reputation as a speed freak and an occasional heroin user. She also used other psychoactive drugs and was a heavy drinker throughout her entire career. So for her first major studio recording, Joplin played a major role in the arrangement and production of the songs that would kind of comprise Big Brother and the Holding Company's second album, which was titled Cheap Thrills. So Cheap Thrills produced very popular hits, such as Peace of My Heart and Summertime. And together with the premiere of the documentary film Monterey Pop at New York's Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, the album launched Joplin as a star. Cheap Thrills reached number one on the Billboard 200 album chart 8 weeks after its release, and was number one for 8 non-consecutive weeks. The album was also certified gold at release and sold over 1 million copies in the first month of its release. So the lead single from the album, titled Peace of My Heart, reached number 12 of the Billboard Hot 100 in the fall of 1968. And another thing that Joplin was also known for was her surprising performance at Woodstock. Apparently, she actually appeared at Woodstock, and she started at approximately 2 in the morning on Sunday, August 17th of 1969. Joplin actually informed her band that they would be performing at the concert as if it was just another regular gig, and as many of you know, it was not a regular gig. On the Saturday afternoon of that weekend, when she got to the festival site and saw the enormous crowd, she instantly became extremely nervous and really giddy. So especially after she was approached by the reporters asking her a bunch of questions, Joplin was really eager to get on stage at first, but after facing a 10-hour wait and arriving to the backstage area, Joplin was freaking out. She did some drugs, drank some alcohol, so by the time it was her time to perform, her voice became slightly hoarse and wheezy, and she was struggling to dance, so it was just not known as one of her best performances, especially at such a huge event. And a fun fact about Joplin is, she owned a house right here in Larkspur, California, where she would often play at other local venues as she was trying to sober up in 1970. Joplin actually appeared at a party for the Hell's Angels at a venue right here in San Rafael, California, on May 21st of 1970. But unfortunately, on Sunday, October 4th of 1970, producer Paul Rothschild became concerned when Joplin actually failed to show up at Sunset Sound Recorders for a recording session. So when they went to check up on her in her hotel, she was actually found dead on the floor beside her bed as she overdosed. So with that, I want to bring the attention over to the legendary Jimi Hendrix and his band, the Jimi Hendrix Experience. So although his mainstream career spanned only 4 years, Hendrix is actually known as one of the most influential electric guitarists in the history of popular music. And he's one of the most celebrated musicians of the 20th century. Hendrix pioneered the use of instrument as an electronic sound source. So players before him have had experience with feedback and distortion, but one thing to know about Hendrix is he kind of turned those effects and others into more of a controlled, fluid vocabulary, every bit as personal as the blues with which he began. So Hendrix expanded the range and vocabulary of electric guitar into areas no musician had ever ventured into before. His boundless kind of drive and technical ability and creative application of these kinds of transformed the sound of rock and roll. So Hendrix's career began as he toured with the Isleys during 1964, but near the end of that year, he left the band and actually joined Little Richard's touring band called the Upsetters. During a stop in Los Angeles in 1965, he recorded his first and only single with Little Richard, and this was titled, I Don't Know What You Got, But It's Got Me. So eventually, Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp, who were managers of The Who, signed the Experience to their record label Track Records. And the group recorded their first song titled Hey Joe on October 23rd of 1966. Hey Joe entered the UK charts on December 29th and peaked at number 6. And they became even more successful in March of 1967 with the UK number 3 hit titled Purple Haze, and in May with The Wind Cries Mary. And this remained on the UK charts for 11 weeks, peaking at number 6. So his first live performances, he kind of immediately grabbed the crowd's attention as their reaction was described as true stunned belief with mesmerizing performances. Following his first live performances, Hendrix figured that he needed to do something more dramatic than the stage show of The Who, which, as I mentioned in other shows, The Who was known for smashing their instruments on stage. So Hendrix actually joked, maybe I could smash up an elephant, to which one of his bandmates replied, well, it's a pity you can't set fire to your guitar. So their producer then asked their road manager to get some lighter fluid, and during his next show, Hendrix gave an awesome performance before setting his guitar on fire at the end of his 45-minute set. And when Jimi Hendrix set his guitar on fire, it was actually at the 1967 Monterey Pop Festival, he created one of rock's most perfect moments. Standing in the front row of that concert was a 17-year-old boy named Ed Carriff. Carriff had never seen Hendrix before or heard any of his music, but he had a camera with him and there was one shot left in his roll of film. As Hendrix lit his guitar on fire, Carriff took a final photo, and this photo would become one of the most famous images in rock and roll. And one thing to note about Hendrix, actually, is he mainly played right-handed guitars that were turned upside down and restrung for left-hand playing. And this was very impressive considering how well of a guitarist he already is. And on top of that, changing the way he played everything. So, the album Are You Experience, is one of his most prominent albums, features a diversity of musical styles including blues tracks such as the song Red House and Highway Chili, and the R&B song Remember. It also included the experimental science fiction piece titled Third Stone from the Sun and the postmodern soundscapes of the title track with a prominent backwards guitar and drums. This album spent 33 weeks on the charts, peaking at number 2, and it was actually prevented from reaching the top spot due to the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Another huge album, Electric Ladyland. During the making of this album, their producer became increasingly frustrated with Hendrix and his perfectionism and demands for repeated takes. He also noted that Hendrix allowed a lot of his friends and guests to join them in the studios, which kind of contributed to a chaotic, kind of crowded environment in the control room, and actually led Hendrix's producer to kind of sever his professional relationship with Hendrix. Electric Ladyland was released on October 25th of that year, and by mid-November, it had reached number 1 in the US, spending 2 weeks at the top spot. This double LP album was Hendrix's most commercially successful release and his only number 1 album. It peaked at number 6 in the UK, spending 12 weeks on the chart. And this album also included Hendrix's cover of Bob Dylan's song All Along the Watchtower, which became Hendrix's highest selling single and his only US top 40 hit, peaking at number 20. The single reached number 5 in the UK. But unfortunately, much like Joplin, Hendrix's career was cut short as he passed away from choking on his own vomit while he was intoxicated in 1970. And with that note, I will leave you with a quick break until we discuss a few more psychedelic bands and the end of psychedelic folk, anti-war, hippie movement era with Woodstock. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. Welcome back, rockers. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. So after discussing the legendary solo artists Joplin and Hendrix, I want to bring it over to the 13th Floor Elevators. So the 13th Floor Elevators were from Austin, Texas, actually, and they were formed by guitarist and vocalist Roky Erickson and electric jug player Tommy Hall and guitarist Stacy Sutherland. So during the summer of 1966, the group released a single titled You're Gonna Miss Me, which surprisingly became popular outside of Texas, especially in Miami, Detroit, and the San Francisco Bay Area. In October of 1966, it peaked on the national Billboard chart at number 55. And prompted by the success of this single, the Elevators eventually toured the West Coast and made 2 nationally televised appearances for Dick Clark. And a special aspect of the elevator sound came from Tommy Hall's sort of innovated electric jug. The jug was a crock jug with a microphone held up to it while it was being blown, and it sounded somewhat like a cross between a mini Moog and a cueca drum. In contrast to traditional musical jug technique, Hall did not blow into the jug to produce a tuba-like sound, but instead he vocalized musical runs into the mouth of the jug and used the jug to create a more echo and distortion of his voice. So when playing live, he held the microphone up to his mouth of the jug, but when recording albums such as Easter Everywhere, the recording engineer placed a microphone inside a jug to kind of enhance the sound. So with Tommy Hall's urging, the band also often played their live shows and recorded their albums while they're under the influence of LSD, and kind of built their lifestyle and music around the psychedelic experience, which sort of influenced the whole movement altogether. They eventually released the album, The Psychedelic Sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators, in November of 1966, which became popular among the counterculture as well, and kind of advocated for the chemical agents they used during the performances. So, now for the legendary band, The Doors. So, The Doors were formed in Los Angeles in 1965 with vocalist Jim Morrison, keyboardist Ray Manzarek, and guitarist Bobby Krieger and drummer John Densmore. They were among the most controversial and influential rock acts of the 1960s, mostly because of Morrison's lyrics and voice, along with his erratic stage persona. The band actually took its name from the title of Aldous Huxley's book, Doors of Perception, and this book elaborates on his psychedelic experience. So The Doors actually began with a meeting between the acquaintances Jim Morrison and Ray Manzarek, both of whom attended the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television on Venice Beach in 1965. Their song Light My Fire became the first single from Elektra Records to reach number one on the Billboard Hot 100 singles chart, and they sold over a million copies. They ended the year with a successful new single titled Touch Me, which reached number three on the Billboard Hot 100 and number one on the Cashbox Top 100 in 1969. So, on September 17th of 1967, The Doors actually gave a memorable performance of Light My Fire on The Ed Sullivan Show. But according to Ray Manzarek, a network executive actually asked that the word hire from the song be removed while they perform. The group at first did appear to agree, but they eventually performed the song in its original form anyways. And this was because they had never intended to comply with the request, or Jim Morrison was nervous and forgot to make the change. Either way, Higher was sung out on national television, and the show's host, Ed Sullivan, canceled another six shows that had been planned, and after the program's producer told the band that they would never play on the show again, Jim Morrison actually replied, "Hey man, we just did the Ed Sullivan show." So Jim Morrison in particular was known for this type of behavior. Actually, on December 9th of 1967, The Doors performed a concert in New Haven, Connecticut, which kind of ended abruptly when Morrison was arrested by local police during the show. Morrison became the first rock artist to be arrested on stage during a concert performance. Apparently, Morrison had been kissing a female fan backstage in the bathroom shower stall prior to the start of the concert when a police officer approached him. Unaware that he was the lead singer of the band about to perform, the officer told Morrison and the female to leave, to which Morrison said, "Eat it." The policeman took out a can of mace and warned Morrison, "Last chance," to which Morrison replied, "Last chance to eat it." And you could imagine what happened next. Another incident on March 1st, 1969, at the Dinner Key Auditorium in Coconut Grove, a neighborhood of Miami, The Doors gave the most controversial performance of their career, one that actually nearly derailed the whole band altogether. So Morrison had been drinking all day and missed the connecting flights to Miami. By the time he arrived, he was drunk and the concert was over an hour late. So the crowd, actually restless crowd of 12,000 people, was packed into a facility designed to only hold 7,000. So when Morrison got on stage, he taunted the crowd with messages of both love and hate by saying, "Love me, I can't take it no more with no good love, I want some loving." And as the band began their second song titled Touch Me, Morrison actually started shouting in protest, forcing the band to a halt. And at one point, he started removing the hat of the police officer, threw it onto the crowd, and the officer removed Morrison's hat and threw it. Morrison also took his shirt off and was soaking wet, and he started yelling, "Let's see a little skin." And the audience started taking their clothes off. On March 5th, the Dade County Sheriff's Office issued a warrant for Morrison's arrest, claiming that Morrison had exposed himself while on stage, shouting obscenities to the crowd, and was intoxicated at the time of his performance. Morrison turned down a plea bargain that kind of required the Doors to perform a Free Miami concert. He was convicted and sentenced to 6 months in jail with hard labor and ordered to pay a $500 fine. But Morrison remained free pending an appeal of his conviction and actually passed away before the matter was legally resolved. He was unfortunately found dead in the bath on July 3rd of 1971. And the absence of an official autopsy combined with the death of certificate having no reason of death besides heart failure have left many questions regarding his actual cause of death. And this is where I'm going to leave you guys until our next show, where we will discuss the progressive and experimental rock. Thank you so much for listening, rockers. My name is DJ Blue, and you just listened to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio.